It's time to break the silence and open up the dialogue around the topics of miscarriage and baby loss.
No more shame, no more taboo. Let's ditch it for the sake of our children.
The ones who are, the ones who will come.
And in memory of the ones who never came to be.
This is the Worst Girl Gang Ever podcast. Lizzie Isles joining us from Southeast London. But she doesn't talk like that, it's just me that talks like that.
Where are you from, Laura?
Welcome, Lizzie. Gravesend in Kent.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's not too far. Southeast.
It's not far. Yeah, very exotic location.
So, Lizzie, can you start by telling us a little bit about how you joined the gang and, yeah, your story so far?
Yeah, definitely. So I joined the gang about 2 years ago. And that was, so me and my husband had been married, got married in the summer of 2021. And did the classic, you know, we'll get married, we'll enjoy married life for a bit, and then we'll start trying for a family. So about 6 months after we got married, we started trying. And we got pregnant quite quickly. So I think it was the third month of trying that found out that I was pregnant, which was, you know, really exciting, but also a massive shock at the same time, because you don't think it's going to happen quite so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I was probably only pregnant for about a week, until then started having some bleeding, which at the time I didn't really think anything of. I kind of thought, oh, you know, bleeding in early pregnancy is really common, so I'm sure it's nothing to worry about. And I remember...
When you found out you're pregnant in that week, did you just assume everything was going to be fine?
Oh, yeah. Which is funny, because I have a friend, and she's actually the person that introduced me to you guys. She had had two miscarriages at that point, and we're really close. We lived just around the corner from each other. So I knew that it was a thing that happened, but I think you just assume it's not going to happen to you, or you just assume it's so much rarer than it actually ends up being.
Mm.
So yeah. When it, you know, as soon as I found out I was pregnant, that, you know, that's it straight away. You're, when's my due date? Oh, that means that I'll be pregnant at Christmas, and all those kind of things that I know you guys have talked about a lot. So and at no point did I think this might go wrong. I just assumed that that was next.
And when you started bleeding, did you kind of Google, you know, how likely is it to bleed during early pregnancy? And is that how you found your reassurance?
Yeah, well, so I didn't bleed initially. I started bleeding, so I think it was about 6 weeks when I started bleeding. And I Googled kind of bleeding at 6 weeks. And the first thing that came up was chemical pregnancy, and which is something I'd not heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of the more I read about that, the more I was like, oh, is that what this is? Which I actually really, really hate that term, because I think it completely devalues what you're going through. And it kind of treats it like a, oh, you weren't really pregnant type thing, or, you know, it wasn't a real miscarriage.
Your baby.
Even the term like chemical is so at odds with nature, isn't it? Just the very word chemical is completely so far away from being something natural. And I think that's a really difficult thing for lots of people to get their heads around, because when you think of chemicals, you think of toxic, horrible, you know, damaging things. You don't think of something that your body is producing, which is essentially what it is. You know, your body's starting to try and produce a baby, and that's what's happened. I hate it. I think it sounds so horrid and really, really actually adds to the grief that people feel, because they feel it's something that didn't belong there.
Yeah. And I think it really adds to the grief kind of after.
Change over time. You know, there's lots of words and phrases and medical terms that are changing. I mean, just like the evacuation of retained products of conception. When I first started going through losses, that's what it was called. And now a surgical management of miscarriage is what it says on the tin without it having any negative connotations. And I hope that chemical pregnancy, what's the other one? The cervix, incompetent cervix is the other one. I hope that in time those ones change as well.
So did a bit of Googling, realised that that's what it might be. So that's when I contacted... I think I contacted 111, because it's impossible to get any sort of doctor's appointment or anything in my area. So contacted 111. They had a GP call me back who recommended that I go to the early pregnancy unit, which I did. I think it was the next day, and I had to go on my own because my husband was working. And again, because it was we were both kind of still getting used to the fact that we were even pregnant. I think there was a little bit of like, oh, you know, I'm sure it's fine, I'll just go and get checked out and then, you know, I'm sure it'll be fine. But went to the early pregnancy unit, and the experience, like, I have a lot of respect for the NHS, and I know that, you know, lots of people work really hard, but my experience was awful, because it was, I remember going into the unit, and I was on my own, I was really scared, and there just wasn't any compassion for what I might be going through. And I remember having the scan, and when the nurse scanned me, she kind of said something like, oh, your womb's empty. She's like, I can't see, you know, there's nothing there, you're not pregnant. And just the language she used, I just remember feeling so, I felt so ashamed, but I felt really embarrassed. I felt like, had I not seen that pregnancy test that had said pregnant, and the others that I did to kind of make sure that there definitely was, I think I would have thought that I'd made the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Because the treatment was so like, well, you know, I'm scanning you, there's absolutely nothing here, your womb's empty. So, you know, that I know that that wouldn't have been what the nurse's intention was, but that was really how it felt at the time. Yeah. No one said anything like, I'm so sorry, or are you okay? Do you have anybody with you? So I kind of had to leave and then go over to get bloods done. But they couldn't do bloods on that day because basically the hospital was kind of overrun. It was really busy. So I had to come back the following day to then get my bloods done. And it was only when I did that the next day that I had a really nice nurse who, she was the first person that kind of took my bloods and then went, I'm so sorry. She was like, you know, I'm really sorry. Your HGC's gone down. You're not pregnant. And that was kind of it for medical help. I just, you know, at that point, it was kind of just like a period. So I didn't.
Did they, when they said that your HCG levels had come down, did they sort of confirm that you had been pregnant?
No, she didn't. No, I think she just said, I'm so sorry. I think she was like, I'm so sorry for your loss. It's such a long time ago. And I think, because I found it quite traumatic, there are parts of it that I just have completely.
Yeah,
just can't remember. And I've just pushed out because I'm like, nope, don't want to.
Yeah.
Don't want to deal with that.
Did you, when that nurse said, I'm so sorry, did you feel validated in that moment? Did you feel like you'd lost a baby rather than, I completely identify with what you're saying about how it made the experience made you feel like you'd sort of made it up or made you feel embarrassed. Like, you know, you're wasting time almost. I think that's, get that from a lot of ladies that they feel like they're wasting valuable NHS time because the NHS is under the pressure that it is under. You know, when you go there and you get sort of almost brushed aside, like, oh, almost like a, what are you doing here? Like, you know, that's the feeling. But all it takes is one person to say one kind thing to be able to pull you back into that moment and make you realize how important it is. I'm really glad that you got that. I'm just sorry it didn't happen for you straight away.
Yeah. It did feel really, I felt like I was being gaslit kind of half the time because it was like, well, I don't even know what you're doing here. Like, why are you in the early pregnancy unit? You're clearly not pregnant. And it was just, and I think because I was on my own and it was my first experience of that. So yeah, her saying that was really validating. And I think I might've just like burst into tears when she said it. Cause I was just like, it was just such a relief that somebody had recognized kind of what it was I was experiencing rather than it just being, you know, just another miscarriage. Cause I'm sure they see them all the time, so to them, you know, it might feel like that, but if you're the person going through it, it's so such a massive experience. So kind of, yeah, so that happened, and then, you know, you get the whole, oh, at least it was early, at least, you know, you can get pregnant and you're very fertile once you've had a miscarriage. So I kind of feel like the summer that came after that, all of those things are kind of going around in my head, and I was kind of doing it to myself as well. I remember being like, because the friends that I referenced earlier, her miscarriages were quite late and they were obviously, you know, physically very traumatic in terms of what she went through. And I remember being like, oh, well, you know, well, mine was early, so it's nothing, at least it wasn't like that. So I kind of, you know, perpetuated that myth of completely invalidating my loss.
I think,
and it was that summer.
I mean, maybe it's a bit invalidating, but I think also it offers you some sort of hope as well. I used to tell myself those things, and I've said this before, it's like when someone slags off your brother, you're allowed to, but if someone else does it, it's, you know, it's like, you know, bugger off, stop slagging off my brother. But it's the same sort of thing. Or like, you can say those things to yourself if they make you feel better in that moment, but when someone else says it to you, got, you know, it really does sting
It's not their.
because it feels like they are saying that it doesn't matter because it was early, or you shouldn't feel so sad because you know you can get pregnant and try again.
I think when you say these things to yourself, it's a coping mechanism, isn't it? It's a survival instinct. You know, you say, I think we're sort of programmed to look for the bright side in life. And although obviously, as we've said before, there is no bright side. When you lose a baby, there is no bright side in life. If it's going to keep you going through the day, saying these things and thinking these things, and as Laura said, bringing you that hope, then that's absolutely what you should do. But when it's not, it's no one else's place to say it. It's no one else's place to say, you're okay, ever. You know, we can all be aware of our own mental health, but it's no one else's job to judge your mental health. And that's essentially what it is someone else telling you how you should or could be feeling. It's not right.
No.
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, I don't think I dealt with the situation at the time particularly well at all. So I'm at the time I was 34. So, you know, in the midst of every single one of my friends having babies and everyone around me getting pregnant. And I remember that summer being so difficult because it was just a constant stream of kind of pregnancy announcements and me, you know, us feeling like, oh, well, we got pregnant quite quickly. I'm sure we'll get pregnant quite quickly again. And then that not happening. So actually it's never happened since. So that was our only miscarriage. And what's happened since is we've kind of moved into the infertility space of, you know, continually trying naturally, but also going down the road of fertility treatment and tests and IVF, which is what we've most recently gone through.
Right. So
You've
that.
gone into IVF privately, haven't you?
Yeah, so and I wanted to talk a bit about that because there was lots of things around that that ended up kind of being surprises. So we, as far as NHS guidelines go, you have to be trying to conceive for 2 years before you are eligible for IVF funding. So we hit our 2 year mark in December that's just gone. And we were starting the conversations with them about we'd been referred. So actually, if I go back a bit, we'd been referred to the fertility clinic after 1 year. And throughout the whole process, they've never been able to find anything in either my husband or I that indicates why we can't conceive naturally. So we've both had multiple blood tests. I've had a, is it a Hycosi? Hycosi, I can never remember which way around it is. And yeah, I've had multiple blood tests. He's had lots of sperm analysis and nothing has come back to say there's no issue. So because of that, and because of the way our local council works, we're actually not eligible until we've been trying for 3 years. So I think if you have a diagnosis, you would get funding sooner. But because our diagnosis is unexplained, or, you know, as far as they're concerned on paper, we could get pregnant tomorrow. So we were told at the point that we were about to start IVF that we would actually have to wait a further 12 months if we wanted for it to be NHS funded.
Oh
Wow.
gosh, talk about
Yeah.
changing the goalposts.
Yeah, I know. And it was awful because all the way through we'd had, so we'd been to see the fertility clinic, we'd been referred to King's. So we're going through King's Fertility, which is a really great facility. And it's not their fault because they don't set the boundaries of who gets funding and who doesn't. But it was only when we were in our first consultation in October that the doctor was kind of saying all these things. And again, it kind of goes back to that feeling like you're being gaslit because they're like, you're both, you know, mid-30s. There's nothing on paper that says why you can't get pregnant. And you kind of feel like they're a bit like, we're not too sure why you're here. But if you are here, you know, you can go through to IVF and these are your chances. But unfortunately, you won't get funding for another 12 months. You can either pay privately and do it now, or you can go away, continue to try naturally for 12 months, and then come back and see us then, which is such a, you know, I think we were both just, I mean, I was furious. And I think my husband was just a bit confused. But it's just to have got to that point where we were at the fertility clinic, and it's only at that point that anybody even mentioned it was 3 years, that just seemed like such a mad thing. And it all depends on local councils because they set their own funding for who can and can't have NHS funding.
I think that's so
Yeah, that's
unfair as
it.
well, because
Over and over.
when you're waiting to fall pregnant, when you're trying to conceive, it's such a long journey, isn't it? It's such a long process. It's such a, and you have to have, I know Laurie, I know you'll identify with that, is that you have to have an appointment booked, you have to have something, you have to know that something's in the pipeline to be able to keep going, to be able to have that positivity we talked about earlier, to be able to be, you know, talk yourself into this, through this life, navigating life, trying to conceive, and to get that ripped away from you for 12 months, which is like, I mean, a year in that space is forever, isn't it? Did you look into any other kind of treatment, like complementary therapies or anything like that?
Yeah, so I started having acupuncture the October before, and that's with a woman in my area who is a fertility specialist, and she's gone through, she, you know, had miscarriages, went through IVF and all of those kind of things. So she has been like, she's completely changed my life in terms of how, and I know you, I know you're a big fan of acupuncture, and I wasn't before because I'd never had it. So I was kind of a bit like, I think before I started this whole thing, I was a lot more trusting of medicine and a lot more like, I didn't really entertain alternative therapies because I was like, oh, you know, well, the doctor will be telling me the best option. And I think now, because I'm 2 years in and because of what we've gone through, I'm a lot more like, I understand that a lot of decisions are made based on funding and provision and how much they can do. So I think it was an episode you did, was it Plan Your Baby? And where they talk a lot about initial testing of, you know, everyone gets put into the IVF funnel without perhaps understanding the reasons that are causing it, because unexplained infertility isn't unexplained. They've just not found the root cause because they haven't done the tests that would get you there. So I really enjoyed that episode because I just felt, again, really validated listening to what your guest was saying. And I think there was a lot. I kind of wish I'd heard it sooner because I think that would have maybe changed what we then did next. Because at that point, I think I listened to it just after our first IVF cycle. And yeah, I just maybe wish that we'd taken more time before that to kind of get to the root cause before we just went straight into that funnel and kind of went through what ended up being an unsuccessful round.
So sorry. So that was, when was your, so that was December that you had, you found out that you'd have to wait another year.
So it was actually October. So we were going in October before the 2 year mark, because no one had said, you know, oh, actually it needs to be bang on 2 years. We thought, well, if they put us in and they're giving us consultations, maybe it's just 2 years as like a broad guidance, but they're a bit flexible either way. So it was October that we had that consultation. And I think we both knew that we would self-fund because we knew that waiting another 12 months just wasn't an option. Because you put so much of your life on hold and, you know, you think, can I go on holiday? Can I do this? Can I do that?
It's not even just
didn't want to do it.
I was going to say, it's not even just the, you know, the things like when the stuff that you put on hold is stuff that you're thinking about a year down the line, isn't it? Like the holidays and like, do I want to stay in this job? Do I need to stay here long enough to be able to claim maternity pay? You know, so many of our, of the ladies we and couples we speak to put everything on hold. Can I fly on this day? I've got a wedding on this day, you know, and to then have that pushed back another year must have been such a bitter pill to swallow. So I think I'd have done the same in your position and just decided to self-fund. How much was it, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, it's fine. So our first round cost about 5,200, which actually in the grand scheme of things, I don't think is that expensive. Like I think before we went into it, lots of people have said, oh, it's minimum 10 grand. And so when we initially had that consultation and they were like, you're going to have to pay for it yourself, that was the number I was thinking I'd have to find. And that's the way it was split was, I think the round was 3,500 and then the medication was the remaining like 1,600, I think it was. So, and I think that's really important that people know how much it costs. It does change depending on what you need. So because our case was very much on paper, you know, you're a very standard case. You don't have any particular things in your medical history that show that you might need either more drugs or you might need additional tests. So we kind of had what you would describe as like a bog standard IVF package.
So, the warriorship, we wanted to come and tell you a little bit about it, didn't we, Bex?
And in case you're already going, why? We don't want to know about a fucking ship. The warriorship is our online membership for warriors in this community.
It's packed full of stuff. So we just want to tell you about some of the stuff. All of the content from all of the courses that we ever run is in the Warriorship. So there's loads to get your teeth into.
And we are also developing modules for what happens after.
But not only that, we've also got a ton of educational workshops running once a month. In the coming months, we have got body positivity workshop, gratitude workshop, and loads more.
And on top of that, we also have a resident mental health specialist. And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough,
there's 13 events every month. And there's stuff popping up all the time as well that other people are organising that you can be a part of. So it really is thriving.
And all you have to do is head to the link in our bio or visit our website, and you can be a part of this too.
We'd love to see you there.
Did you find yourself almost wishing that your test results had shown up something, so there was something to work on? I always think that unexplained infertility must be so difficult to get your head around.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it still is now, and I think it's really impacting what we now do next. Mm. Because I think I was just so sure that we, or not sure, but I felt because nothing had showed up, we would go into IVF. There was a good chance that it would work. Like, our chances were given as, I think it was 45 to 50%. So in the world of IVF, that is actually relatively good. I think the national average is around 35. I could be wrong, but we were kind of above where the national average is. And so it didn't bother me as much then, but now we've gone through it and it failed. I think now I'm more like, I want to know what the root cause is. Whereas before, I was perhaps a bit more like, oh, it's unexplained. But, you know, because we have this plan in place and we're kind of going ahead with all of these new things, I'm not that worried about it. Whereas now I'm like, no, I am. It's really annoying me now, I think.
Mm. And did you, when you went for your, so take us back to October. So you got the news that you'd have to wait for another year. Did you push the button on that immediately and say, right, okay, did you take some time to think about it? Did you assess all your options, or when did you go in and have the IVF, and what was that like?
Yeah, so as soon as we left the consultation, we kind of got in the car to drive home. And I remember we were both just like, we're going to go ahead, aren't we? We're not going to, even though financially it's a massive strain, we just knew that we would somehow get through it and we'd find the money and we'd do it, because the alternative just felt like a no-go zone for both of us, I think. So pretty much as we were driving home, we were like, yeah, we're going to go ahead. We're going to do this. So there weren't really any waiting lists. So we went ahead, and it all starts based on where you are in your cycle. So I think I was kind of coming up to midway through a cycle. So we actually started the following cycle. So our IVF was in November. And for the most part, I was going to say easy then. It's not easy. For the most part, I found it really manageable. And I think there's a lot of worry about how the drugs are going to affect you. That was something that I was so concerned about, because lots of people had said, oh, the drugs will send you mad, you know, that'll be the worst part, you won't be able to like hold your job down. And I was planning on doing all of this while still, you know, maintaining the life that I have. And I actually found that part really manageable. So took the drugs, and I was on one injection for like 4 days, and then you layer in the second injection. And all the way through that process, you're having scans, which is checking how your follicles are developing. So they're keeping an eye on you. They can see how and when you're ready for egg collection. So I think it was about day 8, I went in for a scan and they said, oh, you're ready to go. So everything's looking good. You're ready to go. So come in for your egg collection on Monday. So when that happens, 36 hours before you do egg collection, you have to do a trigger injection, which basically gets your eggs ready to release. It matures the eggs that are ready to go. So you take your trigger and then you go in 36 hours later and you have your egg collection. We were due to go in on the Monday morning, but the nurse had said, if somebody comes in this afternoon that has a higher need than you, you might get pushed back. But all that happens is you just move your trigger back. So we'll call you this afternoon and we'll let you know. So they called me. And that did end up happening. So we were due to go in at 9. We ended up going in at 1 on the Monday, which meant that the trigger injection was like something horrendous, like 1 o'clock in the morning on the Saturday night, which I think we went to bed and then we just like woke up and did it. And then we're like, oh, okay, back to bed, rather than kind of stay up for it. the day of egg collection was fine. I remember in the morning, so because it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I remember in the morning going to the toilet and I had lots of cervical mucus. And I remember being like, oh, okay, this is good. You know, my body's ready. We're ready to go. Went in for egg collection. Everyone was really lovely. And again, the experience, I was worried about, I'd never had a hospital procedure in my life. So I'd never had sedation or been put to sleep or anything like that. So I was a bit worried about that. But again, it was fine. And I woke up and they give you a cup of tea and they kind of let you wake up a bit. And then they come around and they tell you how many eggs that they got. And when they came round, as soon as the doctor came in, I remember thinking something's gone wrong. And she kind of came over and stood at the end of the bed and she said that when they went in, I had prematurely ovulated. So I'd released all of my eggs except for one. So they managed to get one egg. And unfortunately, they'd missed all of the rest. And I remember just sitting there and thinking, what the fuck? Like, how does that even happen? Yeah, go, Laura.
How many eggs did they think that you were going to have?
I think it was between about 10 or 15.
Wow, such a vast difference.
Yeah.
But if you did everything that they told you to do when they told you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but everybody's different. You just can't.
I suppose.
It's as controlled as it can be, but you just can't control everything, can you?
Yeah.
How did you feel at that point?
I was mixed between furious and devastated.
Yeah.
And I remember the doctor was fine. I think, I don't know if I found her dismissive because of the situation, because of my emotion, or because she was maybe a bit dismissive, but I remember she like patted me on the leg and she was like, you only need one. And just kind of being like, I don't need to hear that right now. Like, you've just told me that, like, I've gone through this entire process. I had these really good odds all the way through. You were telling me everything looked great. And now you're telling me that you've missed the eggs. They've gone. You have got one. And I know that you only need one, but I also know that IVF is a numbers game in the fact that if you have 20 eggs and only, you might end up with 5 embryos at the end of it. If you have one egg, the likelihood of that ending up in an embryo and fertilizing is really, really small. So I think I was really angry at first and then I was devastated. And I remember having to like leave the facility and there was all these other women going in for their egg collection or, you know, having come out, having had egg collection. It went, and I felt like I was in hell because it was like having to like get dressed and like walk past all these people and go home. And then having to like tell people as well, I felt that, which is so weird because I don't know why, but that really preyed on my mind about having to tell everyone because we'd been quite open about the fact that we were having IVF and that we were going in for our egg collection. We knew that there were lots of people who were waiting to find out how it had gone. And I just remember being like, I just don't know how I'm going to tell them that it basically hasn't worked. Or at that point, you know, it hadn't worked, but we did have this one egg. So we then had the kind of 5 days of waiting to see, firstly, whether or not that egg fertilized, and then secondly, whether or not it developed into anything. So it did fertilize, which was amazing. So then you kind of, you know, you're kind of in this pit where we were both like, this is awful, it's over. Then we kind of get the call the next day where they said, it's fertilized. And then you're kind of like, oh, wait, now we're back in the game. Like, this could be happening. But unfortunately, by day three, it just had stopped developing. So it hadn't developed into a good enough embryo for them to transfer back. So at that point, it was very much, we knew it wasn't happening. And then by day five, they kind of call you again and they say it hadn't developed any further. And that was beginning of December. I remember going out and getting the Christmas tree and just being like, that was like our way of coping with it. We were kind of sat in the car park of this farm where we get our Christmas tree. It's called Christmas Tree Farm. It's very good. And then having the phone call with the nurse and then just kind of being like going off and getting a Christmas tree and like a complete haze of feeling like everything had just ended. It was a weird, weird experience. And it was a horrible experience. I wouldn't wish anyone to have to go through that. And I think it was difficult because we just didn't think it was something that could happen. I know it can. And actually it is in all the material that they give you. that no one ever kind of says to you, or, by the way, there is a very small chance. I think the nurse said it was a 1 in 1,000 chance it could happen. But there is this small chance that either you go in and you get none, or you go in and you get very few because of this premature ovulation that sometimes occurs.
You have had premature ovulation, does that mean you're prone to have it again? So they can sort of monitor it and go in early next time.
Yeah, so we had a consultation in December, and that doctor was so lovely. She was really, really compassionate, and she really took the time to kind of apologise, you know, not apologise, but say that, you know, I'm so sorry for what happened, and I can understand that was really awful for you. What they would do is they would start the drugs protocol like a month earlier, and they would put me on a higher dose so that they can control it much better. So the only way they know it's going to happen is if it happens, which is really unfortunate. It means you have to go through it for them to be able to treat it better next time, which is awful, but unfortunately it's just the way it works. So I feel confident that next time they would be able to control it. It just means lots more drugs and lots more tests as we kind of go through it.
And so that was December last year. And then what's the plan now? What's your plan? Are you going again?
Yeah, so we had a bit of a break. I mean, we've continued to try naturally, but we had a break. We went skiing, which was really nice, which is one of those things I haven't done for 2 years because I've always been like, oh, I might be pregnant by then. You know, I won't book a ski trip. And so we were like, well, right, booking a ski trip. And that was really good. So we got back from that about 2 weeks ago, and we've just started the conversations with the clinic about kind of going in for round two. But I'm quite keen that we get, or we try and get, some additional testing before we commit to that round, because there's been a couple of things that, like, my acupuncturist has mentioned that we maybe get investigated that I would like to do, because I just think, and I think a lot of it comes down to being self-funded, we could go through another round, we could get all the way through it and it could fail, and then we would kind of end up doing all this testing anyway. So I'm trying to kind of get ahead of it as much as I can and do it up front, so at least we can understand the picture a bit better before we then commit to another round.
I think even if you do the testing and nothing comes back, to be able to go into it feeling a little bit more confident, it would be worth it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I'm doing it, because you know, in an ideal world, all of those tests come back and go, yep, still, everything's fine, we can't find anything. But I would just feel so much better going into it. Whereas the way I feel at the moment, I feel like it's worth investigating what these things that we've been recommended are, because at least then we'll know either way.
What are the tests that they've recommended for you?
So my acupuncturist recommended that we look into DNA fragmentation.
Okay, so you haven't done that
one
yet.
Has that not been done?
No, because nothing's shown up previously in my husband's analysis to suggest that. But the criteria for sperm,
so frustrating.
Because they just do very basic testing. They just do their testing
for. If you're going to IVF to spend that much money, why on earth do they not say to you, before we do this round, let's just get this test done? I know why, because that could potentially mean they lose on you being their patient, because if it's if there is, you know, sperm DNA fragmentation and you can treat that yourselves, then you won't be needing IVF. But my husband, 10 years into our journey, got his first ever sperm test, just a basic test. So this was 10 years, 10 losses, first ever test, and everything came back normal. Did the sperm DNA frag test, and it was borderline. So he took some Impril tablets and, you know, just a couple of minor lifestyle changes. But a basic sperm test can be completely normal and there still be a problem with sperm DNA frag.
I would look up, if I was you, look up Test Him. Are they testing.com? Is that who you?
That's exactly what our acupuncturist recommended.
Great. Who is your acupuncturist?
She is called Claire. She goes under the name the London Acupuncturist.
Okay, cool.
She's brilliant. She's really, really good. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Claire. That's great. Yeah, we just had a meeting with Test Him because we want to sort of work with them, and he's such a nice guy, and is so passionate about getting male testing sort of widely understood and available and stuff like that. So you're in good hands there, but that's great. And I'm sure the thing is, I know you said if everything comes back and it's still the same and it's still unexplained, great. But in some ways, if everything comes back and it's there's something that can be easily treated, it would just make such a difference, wouldn't it? I remember my some people close to me went through 4 rounds of IVF and then changed clinics and had some additional testing, and it was the MTHR, is that what it is? MTHR, yeah, and had treatment and then had twins during their next round. But it was so hard to, they found it so hard to get their heads around the fact that they had to go that far before they had that test, which could have been done at the beginning, which could have been treated 4 years earlier, which would have saved them this. And I guess you can't think like that, can you? But it's just such a shame that we think it's either pregnant naturally or IVF, and we miss all that scope in the middle for testing and decisions. And it's almost like the decision-making process is taken away from us unless we really look for it. But why would we really look for it when, as you said right at the beginning of this call, you trust medicine, you trust all these people tell you exactly what needs to happen. And it's only when you learn that you need to advocate for yourself, because no one else is essentially advocating for you because of finances, because of whatever, you have to do it yourself. And it's only through doing that and through doing the research and talking to people within the community that you discover there is all these other options for you to investigate.
Just on the note of sperm DNA fragmentation, for anyone who's listening, I mean, the tests cost probably around £500. Is that, Lizzie, is that what?
Yeah, I think 400 at our clinic.
Yeah. So if you can't afford the test, most of the reasons that people have, is it altered sperm DNA fragmentation or raised for whatever it is? Most of the reasons why there's a problem are can be treated with just simple changes. There's only one reason that would need any input from a urologist, and that's if they have like a cystocele. But most of the things are, it's caused by oxidative stress. So you can, you know, I'm not a medical professional on this, you'll have to look it up, but you can make simple lifestyle changes and take what's it called, supplement called Impril or something like that, and you can just make those changes for a few months anyway, whether you can afford to do the test or not. Because if you do the test and it comes back, and the advice that they will give you is to make those changes, so do some research, wave a piece of paper or screenshot something and send it to your partner, and let them know that they can also help with trying with ruling out that being a problem. It's difficult though, isn't it, getting the guys on board with this stuff.
But there's this website I was talking about earlier, testim.com. there's some really, really interesting blog posts on there about the lifestyle changes that Laura's talking about. It's run by, I think, three men. So it's not like one of those awkward situations where you have to go and speak to a member of the opposite sex, if that's what, if you're going to feel uncomfortable about that. And there's so much information on that website. So even if you just stick that website in a WhatsApp message to your other half and leave them to it, they can explore it under their own steam and stuff. And, what's the harm?
Yeah, I mean, they're just lifestyle changes. And buy them some Impril as well, because he probably won't buy it himself.
Yeah, I've not heard of Impril. I would say actually my husband has been really good with, he implemented lifestyle choices, like changes around 6 months ago. And I mean, it hasn't changed anything in his sperm, but then equally they're just doing very standard testing. But yeah, I think Test Him is such a good tool and has been recommended to me. So it's definitely something we will do, either through our clinic, or because that's the kind of conversations we're having with them at the moment, because they're saying they don't think we need to have it, but I'm pushing for us to have it. But equally, because we're private patients, so I'm kind of like, I don't really understand why we wouldn't be able to just, if I can go and purchase it at any other clinic in London, I don't understand why we can't, get it from the one that we're actually having treatment at. So we've got a consultation with them next week, which is kind of to talk about that and next steps, all those kind of things.
Why they won't do it.
But they won't
IVF, if that's the answer.
Yeah, but I want to say that.
Yeah.
It's tough. That's really tough. Yeah. And so, Lizzie, tell us a bit about your mental health and how you've coped, and if any sort of anyone who's going through this right now, how you've managed, and if you can pass any advice on how other people can.
Yeah. So,
By the way, the door is opening behind you.
I know,
really freaked me out.
Oh, it's closing. It might be my cat. So she suddenly appeared.
Well, your cat has just shut the door. That was creepy.
It is the cat. Oh, she's just come in. I think it was my husband letting her in.
Oh, okay, fine. I was going to say, Tilly. Hi, Tilly.
The year of the miscarriage, that was 2022. I think my mental health was just in pieces. I just remember it was just horrible. I remember getting to New Year's and everyone being like, Happy New Year, and just never ever being happier to see the back of a year. I've struggled so much with ugly feelings. I remember doing one of your ugly feelings workshops actually that really helped. I think that must have been last year. That really helped me get through it. I think the biggest thing that has helped me, two things. One has been acupuncture. And the other one is that I stopped drinking. So I stopped drinking alcohol probably around December 2022, January 23. And it just completely changed my anxiety levels. Mm. And I don't think I was necessarily like a problem drinker before, but I would drink regularly. And I just don't think I maybe noticed the impact that it was having on my emotion whilst also going through this really big emotional upheaval otherwise. So stopping drinking and having acupuncture really, really helped.
I'm glad you said that, because I think the use of alcohol is potentially so dangerous. And I myself, I've been sober for 2 years and 3 months this month. And it's not just like my desire to remove my feelings was so huge, and doing it with alcohol was so instant. Mm. That I really, really had a huge problem with alcohol for those reasons. Mm-hmm. And the worst that I felt in my life, more overwhelmed, not just by miscarriage and loss and trying to conceive, but other life stuff as well. The worse I felt, the more I drank, because I just wanted that instant fix of everything to go away and to take on this. I don't care. I don't give a fuck. Press that big fuck it button with a bottle of wine or whatever. And you get, but it's addictive. So you get into mm-hmm. that, you get into that, sort of routine where it becomes what you do, and mm-hmm. then the desired effect of drinking alcohol doesn't last as long, and you wake up with the anxiety and the remorse and the what am I doing and a hangover and dehydration, and then it impacts on your physical health as well as your mental health. But I think because part of our culture is so normalized to go out and get drunk or just have a glass of wine or two, you know, of an evening, that people don't realize what a negative effect it's having because they don't stop for long enough to realize. And I've been through some really hard stuff since I've stopped drinking, but my resilience levels are so much higher than they were when I was drinking, because I don't have that underlying anxiety through my every single day that I didn't realize was being caused by alcohol. So if you're listening to this and you are worried about the amount you drink, have a go at stopping. Have a go at cutting down, cutting it out. And if you're struggling with doing that as well, get some help, because there's so much help out there. And I'm always, always open to a DM. If you're listening to this and you're really worried about it, drop me a message, and I will so happily point you in the direction of some help, because I think alcohol is one of the most dangerous things out there that people self-medicate with, because it can be so shaming to put your hand up and say, I've got a problem with alcohol. So like I commend you so, so much for making that decision. And I'm so pleased that it's had such a positive effect on your overall mental health.
Yeah. I don't think I would have been able to have got through everything that's happened in the last 2 years if I were still drinking, because like my anxiety would have just been horrendous. And yeah, it's been really good. It's not been easy. Like I think as a society, we still have an issue with and I think it comes from people being worried about their own drinking. Mm-hmm. It's still quite difficult to be a non-drinker, and I live in London, right? So that the non-alcoholic options are everywhere, and it's a much bigger thing here. But it's still quite difficult to not drink and be around people who do, or people still don't understand it, or they think it's a phase. So I'll go and meet up with people, and they'll be like, "Oh, beer," and you're like, "Oh no, you know, I'm not. Like, I haven't been drinking for so long now. Like, I kind of, you know, I say I don't drink because that's just my reality now. But I still think people and society struggle with that. But I would hugely recommend it. Like, I'm with you. It's made a massive difference to my life, and really, really in a positive way.
That's good. And the acupuncture as well. It's one of those things that I think if you're doing something, you feel more positive than if you view it as everything is happening to you, rather than if you can put something back and say, well, I'm doing this, I'm being proactive in this. And even if it's not having an obvious effect, I think it has a mental effect, as in you feel like you're doing something, so you feel more in control, so you feel more resilient. Whereas if you're like, oh, this has happened, you put yourself in victim mentality, and then it's really difficult to start thinking positively because you're sort of weighed down by all this, I can't believe how shit life is. And life is so shit, and I'm not trying to take anything from that or minimize anything anyone's going through. But I just think that, and I know you'll agree, Laura, because you said it before, like once you start putting things in place, you start to feel more confident, don't you?
Yeah, you do. But and also the beauty of seeing an acupuncturist, if it's a like fertility specialist acupuncturist, they don't just poke needles in you. Like they know your whole story. They are there to guide you. They're there to flag up other tests or abnormalities on tests that you might have already had done that didn't get picked up before. If something's borderline, they're like, well, you know, we could treat this. It just, for me, it was invaluable to be looked after by someone who wasn't trying to sell me something. Like, I had complete faith that they wanted the best for me, and they were gonna just give me the best guidance that they possibly could. And plus, acupuncture is quite relaxing. You get a little nice little nap, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a nap and therapy at the same time.
Absolutely. It is, isn't it?
Yeah. I'd absolutely recommend it to everybody.
Yeah, it's not cheap, but you know what? It's just, it's worth it. I'm glad that I gave it a shot. I don't know if it actually, the actual needles helped with anything or not, but I know that I felt more relaxed and I felt looked after, and that for me was invaluable.
Well, also, if you're listening and you struggle with irregular periods, acupuncture is known to be very, very effective at regulating periods. I know it did for me. I never really got periods when I was young. And if you look back in our podcast, I've talked about this a lot, but acupuncture.
I think you only mentioned it a couple of times.
But acupuncture regulated my cycle. And thankfully, you know, I have children from being able to have a regular cycle and therefore fall pregnant. So it's definitely something to look into, because also, yes, it is expensive as a therapy, but if you're looking at IVF anyway, it's obviously a cheaper option if it can be successful. So
can I just share a good website with anyone who's listening who wants to find a fertility trained acupuncturist? Go to www.fertilitysupport.expert and you'll be able to, I think you just type in your location and you can find one near you. I mean, all acupuncturists are great, but, you know, if you're on a fertility journey, you really want to be seeing the best of the best.
Mm. And obviously, big shout out to Hannah Pern and Rachel Sheriff, who are our amazing fertility acupuncturists. Yeah. So if you
want to listen to the episode with Rachel, we talk all about acupuncture on there. Go back.
Season 2, episode 4.
Oh.
I know, that's the first
time. I'm going to check
the memory. Just type in Rachel Sheriff and you'll find it.
Yeah, then let me know if I was right or not.
You're wrong.
I think I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think it's episode 3, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. It's around that way anyway. Yeah. Well, Lizzie, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. And I'm so sorry that you're still very much in the trenches of this awful, awful experience. But I think that sharing your story will give a lot of people help and insight into the IVF process as well. Yeah. Yeah, so just thank you for coming and being so honest and open about the way you felt and everything you've been through.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I mean, that's why I wanted to talk about it, because I think prior to going through the experience, there was lots about it that I didn't know. Mm. And especially with the whole premature ovulation thing, if that helps one person, then it's worth doing. And yeah, thank you to both of you as well. Like, I wouldn't be, I don't think, where I am, and I wouldn't have advocated for myself anywhere near as much as I have done were it not for your podcast and all the support that you give. So thank you very much for that as well, because that's really helped.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's lovely to be able to offer you that. And to keep us posted, won't you? We wish you so much love and luck with your future experience, and do keep in touch and let us know how you're getting on.
Yeah, we'll do.
All right. Take care, Lizzie.
You too. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.